This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff, here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, and we are headed to the winter meetings. Not all of us, but baseball is headed to the winter meetings next week. Jonathan and I will be there. Jim will not be there this year in Nashville, but that's not going to stop Jim from talking about what's going to happen.
I'm not going to talk. All the winter meetings talk will not include me.
We're going to talk winter meetings. We're going to talk about the draft lottery, the Rule 5 draft. We're going to talk about the Scouts of the Year. And in fact, we're going to talk to one of the Scouts of the Year, Cubs National Crosschecker, and 2023 West Coast Scout of the Year, Marty Wolliver, will be joining us. And of course, you know, one of the big things everybody's always keeping an eye out on at the winter meetings is the potential for trades, also free agent signings, which impact us because those trades often involve prospects. Those free agent signings often include free agents who received qualifying offers and rejected them and therefore have draft compensation tied to them. So it affects the draft order. So we're going to talk about all of that, and then we'll wrap up with a question from the mailbag, which does not pertain to the winter meetings. We couldn't even keep our theme with our
98%. Come on.
That's pretty good. All right. Winter meetings, Nashville, Tennessee, starting Monday. The draft lottery is at 5:30 Eastern Tuesday. The Rule 5 draft used to be on Thursday. It's now on Wednesday. It is at 2 p.m. Eastern. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
Probably, yes. No. And then the Scouts of the Year banquet on Thursday. So let's get into the draft lottery. First year, last year, drew a lot of interest during the winter meetings, and it was interesting the way that it played out last year.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't know what to expect in terms of what would happen, and I think there was a lot of buzz in that room, first and foremost. Like, to have it was smart to have it as a live event. Obviously, certain teams were thrilled the Pirates winning the lottery last year. Certain teams jumped up, like the Twins. The Oakland A's probably got the short end of the stick, because they were in the mix with the best odds, as they are again this year, and ended up drafting a little bit further down. But that's why it's a lottery. So I think it's really good for the game. Better than I thought it would be, and I think there's a lot of excitement regarding who's going to end up, nabbing that number one pick this year.
It was an interesting year to have the first lottery, too, just because of the nature of last year's draft, where you had the five players who were all worthy of being a number one overall selection in a typical draft, and you had the Rangers who jumped. I can't remember where they were. They were outside the top five. They jumped up to three. They got – no, was right, it four? I've lost track of who picked where now. Anyway, the Rangers jumped up. I couldn't think of where.
Only we had access to the internet.
Yeah. It's the point I was trying to make before I sidetracked myself with is the Rangers jumped up in a year where they would wind up winning the World Series and got Wyatt Langford, who could be in the big leagues. They get jumped up to four. And then you had the Twins, who I want to say jumped from 13 to five, if I remember correctly. And they got Walker Jenkins, who was a potential number one overall talent. Yep. And the poor A's, who tied for the worst record in baseball, moved down to six and didn't get any of those top five players. So this year's a different type of draft. We'll talk about the draft soon because we're working on the draft top 100. I don't even think there's a clear-cut consensus number one. I bet if we surveyed all 30 teams, you might get seven or eight different names about who should go number one in the draft. I like the lottery in terms of, I think it creates interest in the draft, and I'm all for that. I don't think if the stated reason for the lottery is, oh, this is going to dissuade teams from tanking, I don't necessarily think – I think tanking's overblown. But I think if you're on a path where you're not trying to win, you're building for the future, you're still better off having more figurative – ping pong balls in the hopper to have a high pick, even if you aren't guaranteed the number one pick. Like, it still behooves you to lose more games than fewer games. The interesting twist on it, I think, long term is going to be the rules, and we're seeing it affect the Nationals this year. The Nationals, 71-91 this year, didn't have a very good season, but the Nationals, because they were in the lottery last year, which is the top six picks, they can't pick – they're not eligible to pick in the top six picks this year. They can pick no higher than 10th, and they can move down. And that's determined if the minutiae of the rule is basically revenue sharing, you know, small market and big market teams, however they define it. I look at it as kind of who gets competitive balance picks and who doesn't. But basically, if you're a smaller market team, smaller revenue team, you could be in the lottery for 2 years in a row. But you can't be in it for 3 years in a row. So if you had, I'd have to look and see, depending on how it plays out this year. Let's say the Pirates win the lottery. Last year they had the number one pick. This year they have the eighth best odds. But let's say they jump into top six. Pirates could lose 110 games next year, and they can't pick higher than 10th. That's not going to make it easier for smaller teams to rebuild. And if you're a bigger revenue team like the Nationals are, they, because they picked second last year, can't pick high. So I think there may be some unintended consequences that's going to make it harder for smaller revenue teams to build if they're every third year they can't pick higher than 10. But it is a super interesting process, that's for sure.
Right. So the Nationals, despite having the fifth worst record in baseball this year, as you said, not eligible to pick in the top six. The three teams with the highest percentage chance of getting the number one overall pick are the A's, the Royals, and the Rockies at 18.3%. Those percentages, so a quick recap, all the teams that didn't make the postseason are eligible for the lottery. The odds range from 18.3, most likely down to 0.2%. So the Mariners, who had the best record among the teams that did not make the postseason, have a 0.2% chance of getting that number one overall pick. Jim, you mentioned the Pirates. They're sitting at 3%. And Jim predicting that the Pirates will get the number one overall pick.
Well, the A's are an example.
He did actually just say jump into the top six.
I was going to say, the A's had the worst of it all last year. Not only did they not get a top five pick, they got a top six pick. So the A's still were a lottery team. They got the worst lottery pick in a draft where you really want a top five pick. They picked six. So if the A's finish in the top six again this year, and I think we all agree, A's probably not going to win a lot of games next year, right? Like, we all think they're probably going to lose 100 games next year.
They have a ways to go.
A's can't pick higher than 10 in 2025. And, like, I think that's going to be an unintended consequence of the lottery, that it's going to hammer some of those teams in that situation.
It'll be interesting to see if maybe that's something that they try to adjust moving forward. This is the first go-round of doing this, and you know, I think there's – always going to be some growing pains and some learning to be done. So I wonder if that is something that's already being taken into consideration for the next iteration when they try to collectively bargain this.
Should we, there's a great website, Tankathon, where you can simulate lotteries in every sport. Should I hit the Tankathon button and just
let's do
our own draft lottery?
Here
we go. Number one pick
goes to
Kansas City Royals.
All right.
The biggest leap, the Cardinals jump to number two from number five, and the A's go from one to three. This was not a dramatic move. The biggest drop was the Rockies going from three to seven, and none of the teams in the teens, like the Twins last year, jumped up into the lottery. So there you have it.
The Royals are on the clock.
All right.
What other wrinkles are we looking at here with the draft order and the draft lottery? So the Mets, Yankees, and Padres are in the lottery, but because they exceeded the second surcharge threshold of the competitive balance tax, spent a lot of money, their first overall pick will drop 10 spots.
Unless.
Wow, that was good.
Unless they get a top six pick.
Correct. Which I was wrong about. I was speculating this summer when the Mets were losing. I was like, man, wouldn't it be funny if the Mets won the lottery and then dropped from 1 to 11? But that can't happen.
Can't happen. Right. So if they get a top six pick, that sticks. If they don't, then that first pick drops 10 spots. And if they do get the top six pick, then their second pick, their second highest pick, drops 10 spots.
And I feel like that's not enough. I feel like if I were in charge, their second and third pick should drop 10 spots. Because the higher pick has more
right.
value.
Right, it's disproportionate, yeah. Right? Dropping 10 spots in the second round is not the same thing as dropping from 10 to 20 in the first round. So, yeah.
I'm sure Steve Cohen glad I'm saying this. You know, I want to drop his second and third round pick if they win the lottery.
Well, as it is, like, I don't even want to get into what the baseball world will think if, say, the Mets and Yankees both land in the top six.
Yeah. One and two.
There will be a lot of unhappy baseball fans outside of New York.
What are the odds of that? The Mets have a 4.3% chance and the Yankees at the number 6% chance.
Yeah, well, but that chance is of getting the number one overall pick, right?
Right. We need someone more intelligent than the three of us combined to figure out what the odds are of those two teams getting the 1-2 picks, don't we?
Sure.
At least on the spot here. All right. Some other things we know about the draft order quickly is that the D-backs and the Orioles are getting prospect promotion incentive picks, PPI picks, at number 31 and number 32 because Corbin Carroll and Gunnar Henderson won Rookie of the Year. They were both on their team's opening day rosters as players who were ranked as top 100 prospects by at least two of three entities, MLB Pipeline, Baseball America, and ESPN. So very valuable picks there. And there's a range in the draft that I'm really interested to see where we're going to have, you know, the D-backs, you know, both of those teams had good years. So they're toward the end of the first round. And then they have their PPI picks. Mm-hmm. And then we have the CBA round.
Right.
And I think the Orioles and D-backs are going to make like five picks within about a 10-pick window or something like that. That's going to be an interesting segment.
Well, and I think that not only is it extra picks, but you know, because of the draft pool system, like their pools are going to be much larger than you would think for a team picking in the back half of the first round. Because we look at what the Mariners were able to do in this past draft, because they had the PPI pick, you know, they had extra picks as well, and it allows for some more flexibility. You can be a little more aggressive. You might be able to, you know, get some, especially the sort of high-end high school guys who might be tougher to sign. Although, as of right now, 2024 draft class does not look like the best class in terms of those kinds of players, but they always surface as the spring goes on. So they should, both those teams should be able to have some fun, you know, in the, you know, the back half of that, in that segment of the draft, as you were talking about.
Yeah, we should know those competitive balance round picks. We should know those here in the next few days. The one other pick we know so far, based on compensation for a free agent signing that was offered a qualifying offer, the Twins will be picking at what is currently number 33. And all of this is subject to change based on the lottery and, you know, where the Mets, Yankees, and Padres, did we say?
Yes.
Yeah, where they end up. But the Twins will get that compensation pick following the PPI picks. All right, that's the draft lottery. Let's move on to the next day, Wednesday, and the Rule 5 draft. You guys have, along with Sam Dykstra, we put together a list of all the ranked prospects who face the Rule 5 draft situation this year. Either had to be protected, added to their team's 40-man roster, or become eligible for the Rule 5 draft. Talked about that last week. Now we know who the players are who are eligible for this year's draft. And it's not like the highest-ranked players, highest-ranked prospects are necessarily the guys getting taken. But you guys have identified some intriguing names. We're going to have a story with the most intriguing Rule 5 eligible prospect for each team. And what we want to do here is you guys are going to talk about one of those names from each of your teams that you think could get taken.
One of those names from each of our teams. It would be 20 guys, Jason. I don't think you want that.
Not each one.
I know what you meant.
I was just going to lay out because I know how much Jim loves the Rule 5 draft. So I was going to kind of let him sort of wax.
That's why I'm not going to winter meetings this year until they do away with the Rule 5 draft. I'm not going to attend. It's just my silent protest.
You're hosting a house party. Let's be honest.
We're going to have like 100 people ever listening. Do we get? Will there be audio, live audio? Yeah. Are you going to be commentating or no?
No.
I think you should. So I'll throw that out there. Just like I was trying to get you to go to the World Series, I want a Jonathan Mayo solo cast. You can sit in a corner of the ballroom. You've done it with Tim McCaster.
In years past, we've done it, but it was an intro on, you know, sort of filling between the major and minor league.
Sit in a corner of the ballroom, commenting on each pick as it happens.
Should I do it like in my golf announcer voice?
Well, five boys.
The Twins are approaching the microphone.
But anyway. But I'll throw out a name here for you that's interesting because he really didn't pitch much this year. But R.J. Dabovich, who's in the Giants system, he's a reliever from Arizona State, was a fourth-round pick in 2020. I guess should we explain the parameters here?
We should, yes. Okay. For those unfamiliar with the rule.
I think I have this.
You
like,
do.
I can't keep track
of
all. You
need to set it to music.
All the draft rules of who picks where because they change so much. Essentially, it depends on the age you are when you sign your first professional contract. If you're 18 years or younger, you're eligible for the draft after your fifth professional season. And if you sign at 19 or older, you're eligible after your fourth professional season. And that's
if you're not on your team.
Not on your team's 40-man major league roster. And by professional season, it doesn't mean like if you missed a whole season for injury, that doesn't count. It's like the clock starts ticking. Like if I sign a 2020 contract, I'm a college player, I sign a 2020 contract. 2020, there was no minor league season, but 2020, 2021, 22, 23, now I'm eligible. So RJ Dabovich falls in that boat. He was a fourth round pick from Arizona State. And on the positive side, you look at the stuff and you're like, this guy could help right away. I mean, it's a 93-99 mile an hour fastball with a really flat approach angle. So it has a ton of carry at the top of the strike zone. And while you're trying to deal with that, he has a mid 80s curveball and it's a curveball shape that drops through the bottom of the zone. So if you're trying to catch up to the fastball at the top of the zone in the upper 90s, then he just throws his power curve and you're swinging way over the ball. The downside, and the reason I think that the Giants didn't protect him, is he had an impingement in his right hip. He made four AAA appearances before he had surgery this year, and that was it. So there's not a lot of track record. Now, one of the other Rule 5 guidelines is if you take a guy, I think it's $100,000 now, you have to keep him on your major league roster for the entire season, active major league roster. If you put him on the DL and he's not active for enough, then the rules carry over the next year. And if you don't keep him on your major league roster, you either have to expose him to waivers and then offer him back to his original club for $50,000. It almost enhances his Rule 5 pickability, to coin a new phrase, Rule 5 pickability for RJ Dabovich.
I like it.
That you legitimately could start him on the injured list at the beginning of the season and not have him eat up an active major league roster spot. I believe, and I might be wrong, I can't remember if it's 90 days or 120 days you have to be active, but you can put him on the DL. He can do some rehab time in the minors. So in a way, you don't have to keep him up on the major league roster for the entire season. But so he's interesting just because I do think it's big league ready stuff. He needs to refine a little bit more, but you didn't really get a chance to scout him this year because he was hurt.
And that fits the, I think that fits the profile of guys that we normally look at for Rule 5. I think the tendency is to look for power relief arms, you know, and those guys have a better chance of sticking. But I'm gonna pick a hitter. Interesting backstory. Be curious to see if it, you know, will work, you know, at the next level. You look at last year's Rule 5. The best player from that was Ryan Noda, who finished with the 2.3 WAR for the year, played almost every day for the A's and probably will again. So I'm looking at Junior Severino of the Twins. He was originally signed by the Braves, back in the 2016-17 signing class, signed for $1.9 million, and then was one of those players who was declared a free agent as a penalty for the Braves and international signing violations. Twins signed him for $2.5 million. It's kind of been slow going, and he's developed a power over hit profile that's kind of interesting. He hit 35 homers last year. Did not hit as well when he got to AAA, but the power was still there. The OPS was almost 900. He does strike out a good amount. He drew more walks this year, so you know it's a decent amount of walks. He's shown some – it's one of those things, is it defensive flexibility or they don't know where to play him? But if you're looking at a Rule 5 guy, someone you might want to just plug in as a role player – he's played second. He's played third. He's played some first base, including in the Dominican Winter League, you know, this offseason. So maybe he could fill in at three different infield positions with, you know, some legitimate power from both sides of the plate. I think he's the kind of guy that is liable to get taken, and you take a long look at spring training and see if you think he's going to make enough contact for him to be able to impact. And he's only 24, so it's not like Ryan Noda was a little bit older. So I think that Severino sort of moved himself into position to be taken, and I'm thinking the Twins are guessing that maybe the swing and miss issues will keep teams from being too interested or give them less of a chance to stick.
Yeah, if you have the 40-man roster spot open, the most you're going to lose is 50,000. If the team takes a player back, you lose $50,000. And you know, like you point out, like for the A's last year, they got an everyday player. I mean, it's not like the A's, made it to the playoffs, but they filled an everyday player they basically got for free. And there's value in that. I did check the rule while you were talking about Severino. If a Rule 5 guy is kept on the injured list, he has to get a minimum of 90 days on the active big league roster, or else the Rule 5 guidelines spill into the next year until he gets to 90 active days. Yeah, I think, I'm not the biggest Rule 5 fan. Let's give the fans what they want. There are Rule 5 fans out there.
A lot of them.
I'm gonna go with another player. Can I pick a second player? I know.
This is where Jim's like – no. Tepid response to the Rule 5 and his inability to pick just one player have collided.
That's right. Like in my desire to pick multiple players overwhelms my antipathy, my lack of avidity for the Rule 5 draft.
All right, give us our bonus.
So I'm giving you a bonus Astro. Justin Durden of the Astros. He had a huge year in 2022. I thought he had a chance to make the opening day roster. He led the minor. They led their farm system in a bunch of categories in 2022, and then he wound up not making the opening roster. Came up with a hamstring injury, hit 231 with a 710 ops in AAA. Missed about 6 weeks of the season. This is a guy who was a non-drafted free agent signed back in 2020 out of Southeast Missouri State, but he's got power. He's got some play discipline. He's 6'3", 210, but he's deceptively athletic for a bigger guy. He could play all three outfield spots. And I think this is a guy who could be, he's probably not an everyday outfielder, but a useful fourth outfielder who is available, frankly, because he had a down year. So that's my bonus Rule 5 guy for you, Jonathan. You picking Junior Severino and talking about a bat inspired me to come up with a position player.
Well, you're helping me put together my intriguing names to watch as prior to the Rule 5 draft. So it's just
What's his Rule 5 pickability?
I think his Rule 5 pickability is high because he's spent a full season in AAA. I mean, he missed 6 weeks with an injury, but this isn't a guy that you're promoting. You're taking a guy who's tooled up, but he's in high A and it's a big leap. So I think his Rule 5 pickability. 2080 scale.
I assume it's on a 2080 scale.
Always is.
I'm going to give him a 60 Rule 5 pickability.
Okay.
That's damn near a lock.
Not a lot.
All right. Rule 5 draft Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern. You'll be able to follow that live on MLB.com.
I thought I was going to inspire Jonathan to pick another guy. But we have so many on here. We got to get them
on. I could talk Rule 5 all the time.
Hence, you should do the commentary live at the winter meetings.
I'm just going to call you and do it straight to you.
So Tuesday draft lottery, Wednesday Rule 5 draft, Thursday scouts of the year. Those scouts being recognized this year are as follows. East Coast scout of the year, Bobby Heck, Rays special assistant to the GM and president. The Midwest Scout of the Year, Chuck Lamar, Padres professional scouting cross-checker. International Prospect of the Year, Rolando Fernandez of the Rockies, VP of International Scouting and Development. And the Distinguished Woman in Baseball Award will go to Linda Smith, longtime employee of the Royals, Braves, Rangers, who retired in 2017 and worked in the scouting departments for those teams. And then our guest coming up, West Coast Scout of the Year, Marty Wolliver, Cubs national cross-checker. We are going to talk to him right after this.
It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, and very pleased to welcome in our special guest, Marty Wolliver, who is one of the award recipients at this year's Scouts of the Year at the winter meetings. And Marty, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to be with you guys.
So, Marty, the Cubs national cross-checker, but you have been in the scouting business for 40 plus years. Where are we at now?
Yeah, I just finished my 40th year and about ready to start 41.
All right. So Tigers, Yankees, White Sox, Phillies, Marlins, Cubs, inducted to the Professional Baseball Scouts Hall of Fame in 2009, and now being recognized at this year's winter meetings and at the Scout of the Year banquet. And I'm sure you've been to this many, many times. What does it mean to you to be recognized this year as the West Coast Scout of the Year?
Well, you're correct. I've been to many of these over the years during the winter meetings, and never anticipated being on the stage and listening to so many productive scouts over the years. It was really a privilege, and I always enjoyed it. I look forward to it. And this year means a great deal to me because it's voted on by your peers, and I think that's significant in that you interact with these guys. I have for 40 years, many of them, and it means a lot more probably than some other ways that you would get voted in.
Marty, Jim Callis here. I'm always interested in how guys got into scouting. I know you were drafted out of high school in Iowa, and you played a couple of years as an outfielder in the Reds and Expos systems, I believe. And then you became a high school coach. And if I'm correct, I think you had just taken a job as an assistant coach at Kansas State, and then you got into scouting with the Tigers. How did that come about, and who were some of your scouting mentors early in your career?
No, you're exactly right, Jim. My bat was not very good. When I signed out of high school, I was a football guy at the University of Nebraska, and I was going to play football, and then I got drafted in the summer, and the Reds made a better offer, so I went ahead and signed. Played a couple of years, not very much success at all, played behind a lot of guys, and then went back and, I realized I needed to finish my college degree. So I went back and finished that, got into high school coaching there in the Omaha metro area at a Catholic school, and then at a public school there in Council Bluffs, and wanted to get into college coaching. I thought that's where I wanted to be, and along with the help from Bill Clark and Bob Aldis and a few scouts, I ended up at Kansas State as an assistant with Bill Hickey at Kansas State, and truly enjoyed that. And in the fall, George Bradley, who was the scouting director for the Tigers, came through to watch a fall game and had watched me in high school. And that's actually who I thought I would be drafted by in high school, was the Phillies. But nonetheless, he cornered me afterward and asked if I would be interested in managing and scouting in the minor leagues. And I said, yeah, I'd certainly consider it. If it's with you, it's something I would definitely consider. And lo and behold, at Christmas time, he called and Jimmy offered me an area scouting job with the Tigers in the Midwest and also a chance to manage in the minor leagues, in the rookie leagues. And I took it and left Kansas State then at Christmas and started at the beginning of the year with Detroit.
Jonathan Mayo, congratulations. We love the reception also, and looking forward to it. You've done just about everything there is to do as a scout, area scout, cross-checker, scouting director. Is there one role that you've had that you've enjoyed the most? I mean, do you look back to your time as an area scout and not that you would want to do it now 40 years later. I think that's a job for younger people than all of us. But the more direct interaction with amateur players that provides you, do you look back and miss any of that? What have been some of your favorite spots along this storied career?
Well, thanks, Jonathan. You just aged me and I appreciate that. But all of them, not all of them, but most of them were wonderful places to work. For me, it was always about the people you work with. And if that's a good group, then it makes the job much easier. It's much more enjoyable, a lot more fun to go out and actually see players and interact with all the other scouts. As an area scout, when I first started, I had George Bradley as a mentor and a few other gentlemen along the way that helped me get my feet on the ground and try to figure out what I was doing. Then I ended up following George to New York after I left Detroit to the Yankees when he went as a GM. But the area jobs were fun. It was always a group of guys that you knew and enjoyed and competed against. Regionally, I enjoyed that as well. And then probably my most enjoyable time was to run a department and to interact with all the cross checkers and area scouts, try to make their jobs easier, and obviously try to draft and sign, quality major league players. So I would say that was probably the most enjoyable. Now on the downside, as I call it, the back nine here, I had a great time in Miami with DJ Civilic as like a senior advisor, where he would ask questions and I would try to help him along the way. And certainly now finishing up here with the Cubs, Dan Kantrovitz has been tremendous, and it's a wonderful group there. So, all in all, the majority of the places that I stopped were great, and the people that I spent time with were really truly fun to be around.
You mentioned that you were a football guy, headed to Nebraska to play. That's a serious program there. I think that was in the Tom Osborne days. So you were obviously an incredible football player. I saw that you were also a very good basketball player. Do you remember your stats from your senior year? You remember what you averaged?
No, I think it was close to 20 points a game, and
13 rebounds and 6 assists. That's not bad. So I was curious, in your line of work, and having come from that sort of background where you played multiple sports, when you're looking at guys now and over the past years, do you prefer, is there any preference as to multi-sport athletes, guys that focus, that are strictly focused on baseball year round now? I would imagine it, varies from case to case, but any general preference there?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I was always biased toward football guys. Ricky Williams, we took another gentleman out of Florida that played in the NFL. And just to see if these guys, Eric Strickland was a basketball player with the Dallas Mavericks that we had interest in. I think he went out with Miami at that point in time. But to answer your question, no, it's difficult to be a multi-sport athlete these days because of the demands. The showcases, all the other extras that go along with it. It's difficult to find those guys, but when I do find them, I really spend much more time with them because I think it's important from a competitive standpoint that they're able to put one down and pick another up and compete and succeed, you know, in regards to whatever, if it's basketball, if it's football. So those guys always had a close place with me and spent a lot of time with those guys.
I wanted to ask you about your first round pick as a scouting director. And, you know, Cole Hamels went on and had a, you know, tremendous career. You know, I think he was, if I remember correctly, the NLCS and World Series MVP when the Phillies won in 2008. A lot of players on that roster that you drafted either as a scouting director or involved with as a cross-checker before that. But at the time, there was a lot of concern about Cole Hamels. He had broken, I think, the humerus in his left arm, not pitching like Dave Dravecki did. I don't even know if I ever knew the exact story I'd heard. He ran into a car playing touch football on the street. But there was a lot of concern that, like, how healthy was he? I get tired of, like, oh, you can't draft high school pitchers in the first round because they're too risky. But you had that going, too. Just walk us through that process with drafting Cole Hamels, because there was more injury concerns than you would have with a typical first-round pick, especially being a pitcher and a broken arm. And that was your first-round pick.
It was very interesting. And prior to that, the year before, Jim, we took Gavin Floyd, and at that point in time, Mike Arbuckle stepped aside and handed it off to me. Ed Wade and Mike handed it off to me, and we didn't have a second or third pick. My fourth pick was Terry Jones, who's an agent, and then my fifth pick was Ryan Howard. So the year before with Ryan was really good, and it kind of set the stage, I think, for Cole in that, it's about your eyes and your innate ability to take a look and listen to what your scouts have got to say. Daryl Connor was our area scout at the time, and I probably saw Cole pitch three different times, and each time I went, I liked him even more. Just the command of the changeup was incredible. Even in high school, he had a decent breaking ball that needed work, and his fastball was a plus. And he was very composed on the mound, which he exemplified, I think, throughout his career. So, frankly, it wasn't really a difficult decision. The tough part was staring him down to us, and I knew there was a club in front of us that had a lot of interest. They were a West Coast team, and I actually called the day of the draft, the morning of, and talked to that director and told him that we were going to back off because our doctors were concerned about the medical, and so we weren't going to take him. And I planted the seed, and he said that they said the same thing, their doctors, and once we got past that hurdle, I felt like, you know what, he was going to be all ours. And we did extensive research and looked into it. And Jim, supposedly he did crash on his skateboard into the back of a truck. To this day, I'd have to sit down with him and ask him if that's a legit story. But the stuff was way too good to pass up at that point in time. And, it was a no-brainer. I thought we got a top-of-the-rotation guy from the left side with a plus changeup that physically needed to fill out a little bit. But once he did that, I felt like he could really be a dominant pitcher in the major leagues.
To this day, Marty, you still won't name what team that was that you talked to or who the scouting director was. Like, I appreciate the still keeping it close to the vest now, all these years after drafting Cole Hamels. But I wanted to ask, Jim asked you about the first round pick, but I want to give you the chance to maybe talk about some of the later round picks that you have specific pride in. And I'm sure you have some great stories on guys that you missed on, like a guy, man, I should have gotten him and he went right after us. Should have listened to a scout. I found that scouts like to talk about the guys that they missed on almost as much as the guys they hit on. But are there some guys, and maybe from that successful Phillies team or at any point in your career, that you take specific pride in, whether it's as an area scout or even when you were sitting in the director's chair listening to an area scout for some of those later rounds of guys who turned into really valuable big leaguers?
No, Jonathan, it's a great question. And a lot of the times guys like to have a cocktail or two and talk about all the great players they've signed. And we forget about all the guys that we swung and missed on. And I certainly have got a closet full of those. But some of the ones that I'm still proud of today are, like Dominic Brown, who was a later round pick, ended up being a National League All-Star. Darren Ruff, who I think finished out this year, probably might be the end of his career, but he was a later pick out of Creighton. Tyler Cloyd, a kid that had flunked out of the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And Tyler, we took him, even though he didn't pitch in the spring, on the word of the pitching coach there. That's a good friend of mine. So some of those guys. And then I get into guys like Arnie Baylor, who, when I was with Detroit, when I first started, was a guy that I called on the phone after the draft and offered him a contract and $1,000 with Detroit. And he signed and went on to be a big league coach and has been a minor league manager for a long time. So those are the guys that I really pull for. Craig Wilson, a Kansas State shortstop that played on the Olympic team that we took later in the draft with the White Sox, that got some big league time. Some of these guys probably weren't as significant major leaguers career-wise as some of the others, but what they had to persevere to continue on to get there, it's amazing. What they had to overcome to get there is amazing, and I'm really proud of those guys. And Aaron Altair is another kid with Philadelphia that was a later round pick that finished up, I think, in Korea, might have been in the independent league this year. So there's a bunch of them, and they're great kids, great makeup, great families, and really proud of all of them.
I think that's one of the things that doesn't often get talked about is it's not even just getting guys to the big leagues. Obviously, that's the ultimate goal, but to just bringing people into the sort of extended baseball family as scouts and coaches, you said, I think that's great. The last thing I wanted to ask you about, Marty, is I guess I'm the guy who asks the let Marty talk about how long he's been doing this and how old he is questions, but you've seen the game change in terms of how players are evaluated. And I'm wondering just from your vantage point, how you've managed to sort of adjust with the times, the incorporation of more data and more analytics. It hasn't always been a smooth road, I think, for the scouting industry. And I'm just wondering, since you've been in the game for as long as you have, just what your take is on how the game has changed in that way over the years.
Yeah, that's a frequently asked question. And I consider myself progressive and always trying to look outside the box, did in Philadelphia for many years, and how can we make things better? How can we improve the selection of players? How can we increase the odds of them succeeding and being major league players down the road? Analytics has provided us with a lot of data that, as Mike Radcliffe and I used to talk all the time, we talked about this stuff. We just had a different language than what it is today in the analytics world. So it was always a part of our program, maybe not to the extent that it is now, but it was always a part of our program. And I welcome it. That's certainly a piece of the entire puzzle. The problem I have is what we just alluded to earlier is about the makeup of the player. It's about their support system. It's about how do they handle failure? Who's going to be there to help them through the process? How are their work ethic? How's their aptitude? Are they going to be able to incorporate all the analytics that are presented to them and make changes to their swing or when they're on the mound? All those things are extremely important. And I think sometimes they get overlooked in the analytics world just simply because they don't measure up to what a successful major league player is. And for me, the big part of that equation is to look at a 17-year-old high school pitcher and quantify him based on analytics, not knowing how big he's going to get, how strong he's going to get. All those things come into play. And I'm sure there are some models that try to do that, but that's a crystal ball in my world, and that's very difficult to do. So I think it should be a blend of scouting. Trust your eyes, trust your innate ability, know the support system, listen to your area scouts, and a blend of analytics to really succeed and do well.
Marty, thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time. Congratulations, 2023 West Coast Scout of the Year to be recognized at the winter meetings in Nashville, Tennessee. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at some teams that have the prospects to potentially make a big deal during the winter meetings. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast, Winter Meetings Edition. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, who are about to tell us some teams that have the prospect capital to potentially pull off a big deal at the winter meetings. We like to draft things around here, so we're gonna draft these teams, and Jim and Jonathan will be selecting in order of what they feel is the likelihood that these teams will actually pull off a big deal.
Nope. I thought we were drafting based on which teams have the most prospect. Talent to trade.
Oh, not on the likelihood. Okay, we can
try. I don't know the likelihood.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Just to clarify.
The reason to clarify, because there are teams that have, like, I'll give an example. Braves are not going to get drafted because they don't have a rich farm system.
The Braves are not going to get drafted.
I think that's
In our draft.
Yeah. In our draft right now.
I'm disappointed. I want to go 30 deep.
So in our draft, they're not going to get drafted because they don't have a enough depth to make this kind of list. However, if we were doing it solely based on teams we think are likely to make a trade,
great call.
I think the Braves would make the list because they will trade whatever it is they have to help a team continue to win.
Sorry. Yes,
that's
very good. Place.
Thank you.
Mini mock draft.
We revolted there. We revolted against Jason.
Overruled. All right. So as usual, not only did we not have the parameters clearly set here, we also don't have our first overall pick set.
We're actually all together here, though, so we can actually have
a flip Jim's baseball card here.
My Colson Montgomery card that Paige Schechter gave me. Don't damage my. Are you going to flip it? Is it going to flip with a plastic sleeve?
Side? Who's calling it? Jim. It's his card.
Jim is.
Well, then Jonathan should call because I know the properties of the card much better than him.
All right. This will make for exciting podcast fodder. Heads or tails? You're calling it?
Heads.
There you go.
Heads it is. Jonathan.
I just gave a Dave DeBuscher, got Patrick Ewing in the lobby.
I don't know if it actually flipped. I think it just kind of.
Oh, look at you.
You should have the number one pick.
Conspiracy theory.
Then I got the number one pick when we drafted players.
I have the number one pick because we flipped the card, honestly.
You deserve it. And I was going to steal your team anyway. So my mock draft already knew you're picking. I know who you're picking. I have a mock draft for everything. I do have the mock. Here. I'll show Jason on my screen. That's who he's picking.
Is it the Baltimore Orioles?
It is the Baltimore Orioles.
If you're going to have the number one pick in a draft like this, you got to take the team with the best farm system that made the playoffs and has a chance to win. And I was thinking about, we had a story on MLB.com that Mike Petriello wrote about top five in his estimation starting pitching targets in the trade market. And, you know, if you look at what the Orioles need, you know, they need starting pitching. They don't have it in their farm system. I mean, they have some interesting arms, but it's really mostly been bats that they've successfully been drafting, signing, and developing. So they now have a pretty good logjam in a bunch of different spots that they could choose to trade from. And I think, you know, the benefit is that they're all at the upper levels and could get a chance to hit a rebuilding big league lineup, you know, right out of the gate in 2024. So that's why I think they're the number one pick. You look in the outfield and, you know, you've got Colton Cowser and Heston Kerstad, you know, both touching the big leagues, both presumably deserving of a chance without room for both of them necessarily in the outfield. You look on the dirt and, you know, obviously Jackson Holliday is not going to get traded, but maybe Connor Norby or Jordan Westberg or Joey Ortiz could get traded, and they all have some positional flexibility. You've got Kobe Mayo at the corner spots. either trade him or maybe Ryan Mountcastle's available. You know, on the big league side, you got Samuel Basayo coming up behind the plate. And obviously you've got Adley Rutschman. They can't both catch full time. Basayo's, you know, super young, so he doesn't quite fit the same sort of description as some of those other guys, but they have so much talent pooling at the upper levels that to me, they're the obvious pick.
Yeah, I thought so too, for all the reasons you said. Hence the mock draft. So yes. Who am I picking? Who am I picking at the second pick?
I'm going to say the Los Angeles Dodgers.
You're correct.
So we've been working together a while.
we can just pick for each other. But that's fine. No, I am going to pick the Dodgers. I mean, the Dodgers continue to have all kinds of regular season success, and they only have one World Series championship to show for it. So I think they're very motivated. Their pitching staff was riddled by injuries this year. Whether it's Dylan Cease or whoever, I think they are going to trade for a significant starter this season, and they have the prospect capital to do it. They two of their best prospects right now are catchers in Dalton Rushing and Diego Cartaya. They have a very good catcher in the big leagues already in Will Smith. They have Michael Bush, who is a very interesting bat. They don't have an obvious place for him in their big league lineup. Miguel Vargas doesn't count as a prospect anymore. He graduated this year, but he just graduated. He's a young guy who could be expendable. They have all kinds of pitching, whether it's Nick Frasso or Gavin Stone or guys like River Ryan and Landon Knack and Peyton Martin. And again, they've graduated just this year, but Emmett Sheehan, Ryan Pepiot, they have a bunch of assets. So I actually think they're going to go out and acquire Dylan Cease, or I think they can cost control him, I think, for a couple more years. So I'm drafting them second, and I'm telling you,
wow.
And my prediction is they will pull off a Dylan Cease trade with the White Sox. Those teams also know each other super well. They share the same complex in Arizona. So I think if there's any farm system, the White Sox probably know, you know, not necessarily as well as their own, but, you know, the farm system they know well, better than any other farm system besides their own, it would be the Dodgers. And I think there's all kinds of talent there. And they could definitely work out a match. So I think the Dodgers are motivated, just like you talked about the Orioles being motivated. So what's your Orioles winner meetings prospect tradability?
Tradability? You know, I hedge it a little bit because they've been so reluctant to do. They didn't do something huge at the – I'll say 55.
Whoa, I was going to – I would have gone 70 on the Orioles.
Really?
I think they have a log jam and they need pitching.
I think they need to.
Yeah.
You know that I think there's always that point in time where, like, boy, we've worked so hard to build this incredibly deep farm system. How much of it are we willing to let go? I think that they have the ability to make the trade and not feel like they've sort of – cleared out the cupboards. How about the Dodgers? What's their?
I'm gonna go 65 on the Dodgers.
All right. Well, I'll up my Orioles to 65 to match that.
All right.
I was being conservative.
All right. We went backwards there from number two back to number one. Let's move forward to pick number three. And Jonathan,
I think you're going with the Rays.
I am not.
Okay.
All right.
I was thinking about them, and I'm realizing now that
I think you're just not picking them because I said
that. No. We have a tendency to pick the teams that we oversee or do their list for. So I'm going to pick the Cincinnati Reds. I feel like the 2023 season, they were ahead of schedule. And even talking to people within their organization, like they felt they were ahead of schedule. They're in the lottery, but they finished over 500. They hung around for a long time. They have shown a willingness to make trades, you know, in both directions at the deadline and things like that. I don't think they're afraid to deal. Previously they've largely been making trades to bring in young prospect kind of talent. You look at the top of their top 30 list now, Noelvi Marte, Edwin Arroyo, you know, both came via the trade and, you know, among others. It's not like they're not quite at the top of our farm system rankings, but it's a good system. I think they feel that they're probably close. The National League Central is wide open. There's no clear cut winner. So I think if they could bring in Dylan Cease. So I'll just use him as an example. I mean, I guess I should have them making a trade with the Mariners since they seem to like to do that more often than not. The trade for, I think Mike Petriello put Logan Gilbert on his starting pitcher story. I don't know how feasible that is, but that's a guy they'd have under control for quite some time. I do think that they do have some pieces that are close to big league ready, not quite the log jam of the Orioles and maybe not quite the depth of the Dodgers, but still a very good system and an ability to give them a real chance to win the NL Central next year.
Tradeability?
Well, so we went 65 with those two. I will go 60.
Okay.
This is clearly making it into the story.
I think
it's a tradability.
The tradability grade.
Tradability grade.
All right. We like to draft things and we like to grade things.
Yes.
On the 20-day scale. Yeah. So.
Okay. They don't have to go in they're not necessarily going to go in decreasing order.
Warren, we
tradability, right?
No, that's true.
We might disagree.
That was my idea for how you
feed. Right,
I'm shot down.
This is a hybrid.
No, we're talking about who has. I think we're ranking more to prospect depth, but then how likely we think they're
right. Which means, like, we could say the Reds have depth. But their tradability grade might be lower than goes next. I would go like 57.5 if that were our thing. But we'll keep it at 60. I'll go ish. And I think you're going to take the Chicago Cubs.
I am. And I was going to say, Jonathan's secret desire is when we do the draft top 100, instead of using the 20-80 scale with deviations of 5, he wants to use every number. So he's going to start giving 56s and 61s and 49.
57.6.
Decimals.
Even. Why not? Let's do it.
Is that precise? That's how much we know the draft. We can go that precise. But
I'm sure.
I will go with the Cubs. Again, I think they have a nice combination of motivation in prospect depth. And then they have some redundancy, not as much as the Orioles do, where you can only put so many guys in your lineup in the future. But, they've got Dansby Swanson, Nico Horner signed long-term up the middle. They have Matt Shaw, their first-round pick, coming. They have James Triantos, who was Offensive Player of the Year in the Arizona Fall League, still in search for position. He's coming. They've got Jefferson Rojas, who's a younger shortstop. They have outfielders. They've got Ian Happ, and they have Suzuki signed long-term. They may have interest in bringing Bellinger back. And they also have Pico Armstrong and Owen Casey and Kevin Alcantara. They have Moises Ballesteros, who may be a catcher. If he's not a catcher, then he's only a first baseman, but he can really hit. They need pitching. They have some holes in the rotation. They just missed the playoffs. So I think they have one of baseball's most improved systems, and I think they're motivated. So I will go – so on the tradability now, is tradability the likelihood we think they're going to make a trade at the winter meetings?
Yes.
I'm going
to
go.
It doesn't have to be at specifically the winter meeting.
I'm going to go 55. I'm going to go 55 on that. I'll go 55 on the Cubs.
Okay. All right, Jonathan, pick number 5.
How deep are we going? 30? We're going 30 deep?
This is my last pick. I mean, you already predicted.
Okay. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, so I will take the Rays here. And, the thing that makes this interesting, we'll maybe talk about this more when we get to the tradability grade, is they're not a team that often makes a big splash trade to bring in a big league player during the offseason. They're not afraid to make trades. The way the Rays do business, I'd be more interested to see what unknown A-level player they get in a trade if they trade away a big leaguer. A lot of people think they're going to trade Tyler Glass now. What will they bring back in return? But they certainly have a strong farm system with guys, at or approaching the upper levels. Junior Caminero obviously made it to the big leagues already. I don't think he's going to be traded anywhere. Carson Williams touched Double-A. Curtis Meade is a guy who I could see maybe getting moved. He has touched the big leagues as well. Unsure of his defensive home, but most people feel that he can hit. Mason Montgomery was at the upper level. So they have that. And then they have some interesting guys who've been at the lower levels. So they could pad out if they wanted to bring in, a player. And they're a team that always competes, and they're going to look to continue to do so in that ultra competitive AL East. So I think they have the ability to. I think because they're less likely to really throw all their chips in to bring in a big leaguer. Maybe they do something where they trade Tyler Glasnow to somebody and get a controllable starter in return. You know, they're good at that. So I'm going to put them at a 50 with their tradability grade.
All right. And Jim, final pick of our six-team draft here.
I'm going to go with the Brewers. And they're that this is based on talent. If I was going tradability, like likelihood, I don't necessarily think they're as likely to make a trade because they're not a large revenue franchise. I think they're kind of – I know they just won the division, but maybe going to go through a retooling period. You know, so I'm not quite sure that they're going to trade a lot of prospect capital. But if they wanted to, and they have a lot of ammunition. I mean, Jackson Chourio is not going anywhere. But I think Jefferson Cuero, Jacob Mizorowski, Tyler Black were probably three of the most biggest leaps onto the top 100. Tyler Black's 51 on the top 100 right now. Cuero and Mizorowski are in the 30s. Like those guys all like substantially got better this year. So did Robert Gasser. So did Carlos Rodriguez. They had a really interesting draft with guys like Brock Wilkin and Cooper Pratt. Eric Brown looked great in the fall league.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of talent there. So I think they're very well equipped, but I think their future is going to be these prospects. And they don't have, even though they won the division, we're not talking about the Orioles or the Dodgers here where they've got stacked lineups and you run out of room to put guys. So I'm only going to go 40 tradability on that. I'm only going to go 40, but I do think from a talent standpoint, they certainly have plenty of talent.
Okay, so there you have it. Orioles, Dodgers, Reds, Cubs, Rays, and Brewers, six teams that have the prospects to potentially pull off a big trade. All right, let's wrap things up here by answering a question from the mailbag. This comes from Juan Rod at Shysox J-Rod, who asks, what prospect outside the top 100 will make the biggest jump this season?
I'm going to go with the guy who I just mentioned, James Triantos with the Cubs, who, I don't know, what we talked about him like five or six podcasts in a row. It feels like coming up fall league, we interviewed him. But I don't know, he went to my arch rival high school, so I can't root for a James Madison product. Him or Bryce Eldridge, I don't think, as a proud Oakton High School alumnus. But it's just we already knew James Francis had some of the better bat-to-ball skills in the minors. That's why he was an overslot second-round pick a couple of years ago. And his batted-ball data took a jump this year. Fall league, as we always say this caveat, is a hitter's league. But he was hitting the ball harder. He was driving the ball the other way at times. He's not like a big runner, but he was more aggressive on the bases. I still know what position he's going to be, but I do think he got the double A at the end of the year. I do think like I can see James Triantos hitting 320 with 20 homers in the minors this year. And a guy who's a very deep Cub system, he's not quite on the list, jumping. And maybe he's a guy like we're talking about, different type of player, but like I just mentioned, Tyler Black, who's in the middle or even higher, you know, at the end of next season. So I just said James Triantos is my pick. And I did limit myself. There are so many potential answers to this pick. I'm only picking one. I'll probably use this question in the pipeline and inbox, and I will pick extra guys. I will pick extra guys, but I'm only picking one, even though this is much more fascinating than me, the Rule 5 draft. And I gave you two Rule 5 guys. So.
See, I still don't trust that he's not going to circle back after you.
Only Jim could talk another 30 seconds about how he wasn't going to pick another guy. I'm going to pick Colt Emerson of the Seattle Mariners. And when we sort of looked at this, I'm always intrigued by the guys from last year's draft, especially the high school guys, where you know, you don't know what they're going to do. He was the Mariners' first-round pick, 22nd overall last year. You know, from the Ohio high school ranks, you know, you look at the Mariners track record, you know, Cole Young worked his way into the top 100, Harry Ford's in the top 100, they've taken high school bats. So I feel some comfortability that they know what they're doing and picking guys who are going to have really strong first full seasons. He's super athletic. He was a really good football player and it's only been focusing on baseball for a short period of time. It was until his senior year of high school. And he went out and had a really good but brief pro debut where he had an OPS over 1,000. He's going to hit. There's going to be power, I think, more power to come. The only real question is whether or not he stays at shortstop forever. But he's played third before. He looked fine there. Cole Young might be in the way eventually anyway. But I don't think it's going to matter. I think this is the kind of high school guy that he goes straight to full season ball. plays across two levels, if not more, in his first full season. You know, sort of what the Mariners have been doing. If they show they can hit, Cole Young play between, you know, A and high A. I could see him putting up some really good numbers across those two levels and making that big jump into the top 100 in 2024.
Good question, Juan Rod. Thank you very much. And thanks very much to Marty Wolliver for joining us on today's episode of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. And thanks to everybody for listening. That's going to do it. We're going to wrap up here, aren't we?
Yeah,
good to see you guys, Jim.
John, Jim, last chance. You want to throw in another name?
I'm going to wait. You have to wait for the inbox.
I'm trying to buy time for you. All right. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.